Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today I'm very pleased to welcome to the programme the writer and lecturer Edward Curtin, who teaches sociology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He has a very wide array of interests, having been educated in the classics, philosophy, literature, theology, sociology. However, while nevertheless being an academic by profession, he writes, as indeed he explains on his website, and I'm going to quote him here, he writes, as a public intellectual for the general public, not as a specialist for a narrow readership. Unquote, which I think is certainly very refreshing. And some of that work can be sampled over at his website, Edward Curtin Behind the Curtain, which you will find at edwardcurtin.com. It's very good to have the opportunity to speak to you. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Julian. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's wonderful of you to come on because I came across your work fairly recently, really, probably just a couple of months ago. And that was through reading a couple of, I thought, fascinating articles by you online. And I want to discuss both of those with you today. I mean, one in which you reviewed the book, which I think is very important, a new book by David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodworth called 9/11 Unmasked, an International Review Panel Investigation. And we will spend a little bit of time talking about that today, but also a very interesting piece that you wrote called Why I Don't Speak About the Fake News of 9/11 Anymore, in which you you explore some of the reasons why you suspect that, and you call it this, you suspect that linguistic mind control, we will get into perhaps what that means in a minute, you suspect that linguistic mind control was involved in the planning of that tragic and indeed deceptive event. And that will, I think, be the main subject of our conversation today. But in that second piece, you also talk about how you became personally involved with the subject of 9/11, and that was involving the experience of your family. So I'd like to start there, if we may. What was it that triggered your concern to think and write about this very controversial subject?
Well, it began on the morning of September 11th, 2001. I was home that morning, not teaching, and my daughter and her then boyfriend, now husband, had just been here visiting us from New York City for the weekend. They had actually made a short film in the area here. And they had gone on a week vacation to Cape Cod off the coast of Massachusetts. And that morning I was reading or doing something, I don't recall, and the phone rang. And my daughter called me from a cottage on the beach on Cape Cod and said, Papa, quickly turn on the TV. And I said, why? And she said, a plane has crashed into the World Trade Tower. So I turned on the television. It was a few minutes past nine, and I saw a plane crash into the tower. And I said to her, oh, I just saw it. They must have shown a rerun.
Right, yeah. Yeah, a replay. Absolutely. Yeah, sure.
A replay. She said, no, that's not it. That's a second one. I didn't see the first one, but I heard the news. And the second plane hit the South Tower, where her then boyfriend worked. Mm. He worked at, I think it was the 100th floor or the 101st floor, and he had taken a vacation, the only vacation he had taken in a year, that very week.
Wow.
So we stayed on the phone and we watched the TV together for a while. And that's where my emotional interest began. Of course, it would have begun anyway, but this was rather shocking. Mm. And it turned out that over 200 of his fellow workers in that South Tower died. And he would have been there at that time. And he would have been far above where the plane hit. I think it hit at the 77th floor at the South Tower.
Wow. He must have been absolutely stunned by that event. Does he talk about it anymore?
Well, no, he doesn't. And that's interesting also. Mm-hmm. I recently asked him, I said, what have you thought in these intervening years? And he told me, you know, I really haven't thought about it much.
Perhaps he tries to put it out of his mind. Maybe that's a reaction.
Yes, and actually I have my niece's husband was a New York City police detective, an anti-terrorism detective, who was the first person in a helicopter above the towers that morning. And I recently asked him also, what have you thought over these years? And he said, I just tried to put it out of my mind.
That is a very interesting response. So that might actually link into some of what we're going to talk about later. Do you also have family connections to the New York Fire Department?
Yes, my grandfather was a deputy fire chief of the New York City Fire Department. And I have relatives in the police and fire department in New York City. But he held quite a high position. At the time, it was the highest uniform position in the fire department.
So you have some sort of emotional attachment already to the city of New York, I guess, because of those connections. You say that you were immediately suspicious of the event. And let me quote here, what I was hearing wasn't believable, you say. Why do you think you had that reaction?
Well, that's a good question. I said to a former student of mine who reminded me of what I told him, that very day we talked, and he was a student at the time, and I said, it doesn't make sense. I don't believe what I'm hearing. And I didn't even recall saying that. But in the subsequent days, the feeling that there was something wrong with this explanation was growing within me. But it took a while for me to start to look into it. I was suspicious.
Indeed.
And I should say I grew up in New York City.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah, you say that you had a suspicious rage that was developing in you about this.
Yes, yes. Because it seemed to me to echo other things that I have studied and written about over the years. For some reason, well, I guess for an obvious reason, the government lies about the assassination of President John Kennedy sprung to mind, as well as the assassination cover-ups of his brother Robert and Dr. Martin Luther King. So I was, being a sociologist and being of a skeptical mind, I suppose all of these things came together to make me highly suspicious of the official explanation.
So it was very much a gut feeling, but informed by your previous research and suspicions. And you say in the piece that by 2004, through reading the works of, again, people like David Ray Griffin, and you mentioned Michael Ruppert, I don't know if it's Ruppert or Rupert, you came to the view that 9/11 was, and I'm going to quote you here directly, quote, you came to the view that 9/11 was a deep state intelligence operation whose purpose was to initiate a national state of emergency to justify wars of aggression known euphemistically as the War on Terror, unquote. And we're going to explore a likely aspect of that deep state operation with some indications of linguistic mind control with respect to that event in a few minutes from now. But first, let's turn to this book, 9/11 Unmasked, by David Ray Griffin again and Elizabeth Woodworth, recently published by Olive Branch Press. And I'm going to put links to that in the show notes. Now, as I said, you reviewed this, and your review was widely shared across the internet, and you gave a very, very glowing review of this. You described it as the definitive book on the subject, which certainly encouraged me to go and request it from the publishers. Now, I said to you before the interview that I've got about a third the way through, and initially I was thinking, well, how good is this going to be? But the more and more I read, the more significant I'm aware this book actually is. Could you tell us why you think this book is quite so important and why you wrote such a glowing review for it?
Sure. I had read, as you said, in leading up to the conclusion I arrived at, increasingly reaching it by 2004, when I actually taught a course on the subject. I had read everything that I could get my hands on, David Ray Griffin, Michael Rupert, the 9/11 Commission Report, a book by a British researcher whose name escapes me at the moment, a very good researcher. So I had studied it intensely and reached the conclusion that the official story was obviously ridiculously false. And so I taught a course on it.
So you taught a course actually at your college, did you?
It was at a different college.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And the Michael Rupert book was an important book, as well as David Ray Griffin. And actually, the students read five very, very, very long books and studied it closely and all arrived at the same conclusion. Mm-hmm. With no pressure from me. I'm not that type of teacher who would ever try to pressure them.
What was their position beforehand? Did you poll them to find out what they thought to start with?
Yes. Most of them had a little bit of doubt about it, but not a great deal, because this was rather early on in 2004. There were a few of them. I had one student who was from France who clearly did not believe it, which was interesting. Yeah, and he did a lot of work in that course, particularly. What? But he was highly suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking, what a fascinating course actually to attend, that your lecturer is actually considering these things in an open way. And so, you know, there wouldn't be all the raised eyebrows and the, you know, the nods and the winks, or look, there's a nutter over there, because you would have set the conditions, presumably in the class, where there was this openness where people could discuss any point of view with respect to it.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Very refreshing.
Thank you. It should be the way everything is taught.
Well, it should be, but unfortunately isn't very often. Yeah. Okay, so this project itself, now this comes out of the 9/11 Consensus Project. We have mentioned this on the show before and referenced their website, which was consensus911.org. I think that project itself started 2011, something like that. And there were 23 experts, I think, in various fields. But they decided, the two main authors of the book, I think they decided that it would be best to move into a volume of publication like this. Have I got that right?
Yes. I think it was 2012 when they started on this. It might have been 2011. And so it took a long time. And there was a group, I think it was 23, very, very well-respected people from many, many different fields, physics, chemistry, engineering, piloting, many others. I can't remember all the different fields, many of whose names I knew and whose work I knew. So David Ray Griffin and Elizabeth Woodworth gathered these people and got them to agree to do this, what they called the Delphi model, which was studying the best evidence in a certain methodical way, you know, a scientific way, or call it a quasi-scientific, if you wish.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit more about that method? That is one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because you have a high regard for that approach. I don't know whether it is a single method or a group of approaches, but could you give us more of an idea of how that works?
Yes. What they do in this method, which is used in science and in medicine, they only reach conclusions after a consensus is reached. Each claim is subjected to each person who's participating in this review and this feedback process, and their responses are submitted to the two people, in this case, who are moderating the panel study. And in order to be accepted, each point that they're studying, you have to have at least 85% agreement, and if not, the issue that is being examined is rejected.
Right, I see. So it does involve a filtration process. And I think they say in the book there were some issues that didn't reach that threshold, and so they don't actually appear in the book. Not because they have nothing to them, but because they didn't reach that particular threshold of agreement, which I thought was interesting that they did it that way. So everything that's in the book does reach this 85% of agreement amongst these particular scholars who've had a great deal of interest in this over the years.
Yes, and all of whom had done previous research. So in that respect, their opinions on various issues were known in advance, but this was done blindly. You know, the names were not used in the process.
Okay, well, let's just give an idea of what they actually cover here. They look at the destruction of the Twin Towers, the destruction of WTC-7, the attack on the Pentagon, the 9/11 flights, U.S. military exercises on and before 9/11, claims about military and political leaders, Osama bin Laden and the hijackers, the phone calls from the 9/11 flights, the question of insider trading. So quite a chunk there of 9/11 studies. And then they sort of give background to each of these issues. They then present the official account, and then they present what they call the best evidence with respect to that particular issue, and then they present a conclusion. And that's the way that works throughout. Is it that particular way of presenting things that made you think this is the book? What did you call it again? The definitive book?
Yes, I think I said the definitive book on the subject. Mm. I think that's true because I think it's a summation of the results of all of the research that has been done by David Ray Griffin, Graham McQueen, and so many other people. And it's presented in such a logical, sequential way, argument for and against with conclusions, yes, that is just a devastating, devastating critique of the official explanations for what happened that day.
Yeah, so I do agree, actually. And of course, that is important to point out, that it's not about propounding a particular theory, is it? It's showing the gaping holes in the official narrative and then kind of inviting you as the reader then to make an inference to the best explanation. If you're thinking about culpability for what happened that day, then it's left to you to think what you think is the best explanation overall, considering all those issues throughout the book. And it has really copious endnotes, doesn't it? And they're also arranged in numerical sequence right the way through, so you don't have to find the right number for each chapter, which I always find irritating with these things. Yes. Very, very easy to find everything, and it's comprehensive in those endnotes. One thing I'd like to put to you, I think some people might say a weakness with this is that all of these experts are on side with this particular issue. Might it not have been better to have a volume containing, you know, articles for and against the official narrative? You know, kind of a debate book. There was a book that came out called Debating Design a number of years ago, and that was a very effective book because it did it that way. Why do you think it was such a good way to do it this way, you know, rather than a debate?
Well, that's a really good question, Julian. Yeah. I can't speak for David Griffin and Elizabeth Woodworth or any of the others. But I suppose what I think is that the events of 9/11, and I shouldn't use the numbers, I get caught myself using them.
But I just let people into the secret there. We're going to talk about that very issue in a few minutes from now. Yeah, it's unavoidable, so yeah, go on.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. I think that the folks involved and the authors believe that to really give any further credence for the official explanations for the events of that day is to open up a pseudo debate that would lead nowhere. To use a phrase from someone whom I know who was an early critic, very early, almost immediate critic of the JFK official explanation. His name is Vince Salandria, very eminent, brilliant man. He said that to keep debating the JFK assassination is to debate a false mystery concealing state crimes. And I think that the people who served on this panel and the authors feel the same way. So that's my guess. No one has ever really told me.
Hmm. Yes, I see that, actually. I think there are, you know, debate can work very well, but it can also be an opportunity for obfuscation. And I think, well, you know, there may be a place for that kind of thing, but there's also a place for this kind of book too. So it has its place anyway in the marketplace of ideas, just as a very strong statement, an incredibly strong statement. So I'm highly recommending this. I'm going to say that I wasn't sure when I started reading it that I was going to find it as effective as I now do. But the more I have read, the more I am realizing this is a very important book. And I think that anybody really concerned about this subject ought to get a copy of this. So I'm not just recommending it. I'm saying you ought to get it. I think we're probably beyond the time now of merely sort of pointing people to documentaries, handing out DVDs. And there's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, I think we're beyond that. We need real substance in the form of academic argument that's nevertheless easy to engage with because it's so very well written, which is the case with this book. So I think it's just the kind of thing to give to people if they show any interest in questioning the events of that day. So get a copy of it. I'm not under commission for saying this, by the way. I am actually recommending it. Perhaps even get half a dozen copies to give out to people. It is an excellent book. Okay, so let's turn to the issue that you concentrate on in your article, why I don't speak of the fake news of 9/11 anymore. So this is the likely role of what you call linguistic mind control of the US population, indeed beyond the US, by the deep state, through the ways in which the language of 9/11, there's the phrase itself, the language of 9/11 has been and does in fact continue to be presented. So there's loads to discuss here, but the obvious first question to you is, what do you mean? You use this term linguistic mind control. What are you getting at with that?
Well, it's rather simple. It is the use of language in ways meant to confuse and confound people about significant issues. And I think it is a technique that has been honed down through the decades by intelligence services here in the U.S., in particular by the CIA, going all the way back to their use of the term conspiracy theory, which they put out in, I believe it was 1967, to all of their people within the agency and throughout the mass media that they had placed in important positions, and people who did their bidding, they told them back then, besmirch anyone who questions the JFK assassination, call him a conspiracy theorist, and that will be that. You know, they'll be considered nuts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it goes back a long way. It goes back to Orwell in 1984 and the use of language to confuse people and to say war is peace and hate is love. And to create a whole dictionary of this stuff. So that's what I mean by linguistic mind control. And I think it was really in effect when 9/11 happened, and it was used before, during, and after to solidify social memory about that day.
And you say that, and I think you're being slightly facetious, but I know what you mean. You say that this language feels like it comes from a secret manual. That's your quoting you there, a secret manual. And that through hearing it, people have adopted this language for themselves, which I think is quite creepy, but I think you're onto something there. And you suggest that maybe this is why even people, public intellectuals like Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, etc., they've kind of made up their minds already, maybe because of the function of this language. Some people call them gatekeepers, you know. What do you think about this?
Well, I don't think Chomsky or Zinn's minds were conditioned by the language.
Uh-huh.
No, nor someone like Alexander Colburn. Mm. And there are quite a few others, left-wing leftists who refused to entertain 9/11. But as you see, again, to make fun of myself, I just used a term again.
Yes, so that's right. Yeah.
It's very powerful.
Yeah, and of course, it's on this title of 9/11 Unmasked. I know that's so that people understand what it's about. But yes, it's that powerful. You can't escape from it altogether.
Yes. Well, I don't think that those people are confused by language. I think they have a different agenda.
Right.
You would have to ask them what their agendas are.
Sure. I just wonder what you thought about it, because we have actually touched on that sort of thing before. We talk more in terms really of unthinkability and also whether one's case might be discredited by championing certain ideas along those lines. So yeah, there could be all sorts of reasons why people don't talk about a particular issue.
Well, if I could just to follow up on what you said, unthinkability. Graham McQueen, who is one of the people on the consensus panel, wrote a book called The 2001 Anthrax Deception.
Indeed.
The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, which is really a very, very, very important book.
Can I just jump in there? We did, in fact, have an interview with him about that book. So if anybody listening has not heard that interview or read that book, please do. It is indeed a hugely important book, the way it dovetails into the issue of 9/11. And it was very excellent as well to speak to him. Yeah, go on. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. Just to go back to the unspeakable, I think that was the word you used.
Unthinkable, actually. But the two are linked.
Yes, unthinkable. Well, he has a whole section on the use of the unthinkable in that brilliant book, which is very closely connected to the events of September 11th, 2001, before, after, plus the anthrax attacks. And if you go to the issue, which I think is linked, the assassination of President Kennedy, which Chomsky, Colburn, Zinn, and all these people won't go near with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. They say it's not even important. There's a word that was used by a Trappist monk, famous Trappist monk named Thomas Merton, who also died under suspicious circumstances in December 1968. But I won't go into that now. He uses the word the unspeakable. There are certain things that you can't say. There are certain things that are beyond the pale. So the unspeakable, and what was that other phrase we just used?
The unthinkable.
Yeah, the unthinkable, the unspeakable. Mm. These are discussions that are really off the table, outside the pale, and we shouldn't even be talking about.
Yes, indeed. And this is what James Douglas in his book about JFK, of course, includes this in the title. He really brings this out, doesn't he, in the text very much. And he describes it as a void. A kind of huge negation that somehow sucks thought into it. It's a difficult thing to describe, but I think to a certain extent he uses it in order to invite us to fill that void with the conclusions that he's pointing towards. And I do want to come to that later, particularly to do with this language to do with World War II, because I think there's something of the unthinkable stroke, unspeakable void about that kind of language. Now, this is going to mystify listeners at this moment, but it'll become clear in a few minutes from now.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about.
Of course.
Yes. So let's turn to some of these terms that you discuss. There are many, of course, but you limit yourself to five in the article. We may come across more. You may wish to share more with us, but let's stick for the moment to the ones that you bring out. The one that I'm already familiar with a lot, because David Ray Griffin himself wrote a book called The New Pearl Harbor, is the term New Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, referring obviously back to that event there in 1941, but here the New Pearl Harbor. So this term was floating around before 9/11 and has appeared since 9/11. So what's going on with that one? Why is this being used? How is that being used?
Well, it's a really powerful term because most people, most Americans, have a visceral reaction to hearing about the attacks on Pearl Harbor and the killing of so many American sailors and Marines on that day. But they don't know a great deal about the truth of the attacks of Pearl Harbor. So the folks who conjured up the use of this term Pearl Harbor surrounding the events of September 11th know that it has an emotional impact. And so we'll go back 1 year to September 2000. There was something, as you well know, called the Project for the New American Century, which was composed and created by all of these neocons many, if not most of whom served in the Bush administration and who still are a powerful force. And they had a report called Rebuilding America's Defenses. And in that report, they argued that absent some catastrophic event, something similar to a new Pearl Harbor, the United States will not be able to do what they want to do in the Middle East, that is, attack Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Iran, and so forth. And so that was 1 year before the date. And then the term was used repetitively by Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense. He used it multiple times. And to me, one of the more interesting things is that the hit movie of that summer, even though it didn't get great reviews, was a movie called Pearl Harbor. And that film, it was the, was it the 40th or the 50th anniversary?
The 60th. Yeah.
Pearl Harbor happened in early December, and that would have been a more likely release date for this film. But they put it out on Memorial Day, that is the end of May 2001. And so it was in the theaters all summer. Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor. It was in the public consciousness constantly. And then when the events happened on September 11th, it was referred to as a new Pearl Harbor, another Pearl Harbor. George W. Bush was reported to have written, he had time to write in his diary that night, "Dear Diary, the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today." And they kept pounding it, Pearl Harbor. And I think it had this powerful emotional resonance with the American people. Like, again, a sneak attack from over there.
And you say that, going back to Donald Rumsfeld, that he was also handing out to people a particular book called Pearl Harbor, published in 1962 by somebody called Roberta Wallstetter.
Yes, he was.
That was rather interesting that he should be doing that as well. Of course, before the event, yeah.
Yeah, he was. And she was a woman who, for a few decades, worked for the RAND Corporation, which is a quasi-U.S. military organization. Daniel Ellsberg worked for the RAND Corporation. And she claims that the United States was shocked by a surprise attack from the Japanese. And that is simply not the case. But Rumsfeld wanted to push that line, and he wanted to push the idea of Pearl Harbor, which he did continually.
Hmm. So do you think the term was used very much more in the months leading up to the attacks? Or, I mean, is there evidence of the term being used a lot in the decades leading up to that time?
Far less in the decades, but definitely in the year from September of 2000, and by particular people. I think that's really important.
Yeah.
By the people who are involved in the Project for the New American Century, by Cheney, by Rumsfeld, by the people who were in charge on the day that September 11th happened. They were pushing it.
Mm. Yeah, that is certainly very interesting. Because I am interested also by this idea about the film coming out. You say that, of course, was Pentagon-assisted. We know largely through the work of Tom Secker that an awful lot of these films are Pentagon-assisted. But I'm wondering whether it really is that unusual for it to be released earlier in the year. I mean, are there not other films that are, you know, they commemorate something and then they come out earlier than you might expect?
That's a good point, Julian. I remember, and I've never been able to confirm this. It was my understanding in 2001 that movie was supposed to come out in December. Uh-huh. And I remember reading, but I can't find it. It seems to have disappeared. And I may be wrong.
Sure.
That the film's release was pushed forward to Memorial Day for some reason.
Right.
Unexplained.
yes. It wouldn't surprise me. There are lots of weird things like that surrounding this event, aren't there? Things pushed back and forth, yes, indeed, in unexplained ways.
Yeah, but I can't prove it.
No.
I've tried.
Mm-hmm. No, well, I think this discussion is like that. It's not about assembling a mass of proofs, rather different from, of course, the book that we've been discussing. But I think there's room for this kind of discussion because we kind of need to go beyond absolute proofs, because if we're always sticking at just at the level of proof, that we're, you know, there's going to be a lot that we're going to miss. And I think it's important to have these slightly looser conversations if we want to get to the truth of issues that are more veiled, because not all of life is above the surface in such a way that you can have certainty. So that is World War II language, which is very potent, as you've already mentioned. There's more of this World War II language. We have your second point here, which is the term homeland, which you describe as strangely un-American. And I agree with you. Immediately, I think, of course, of Nazi Germany. So go on. What's happening with this term?
Well, that is straight out of Nazi Germany. Mm. And this term was used many times leading up to September 11th, in the same document by the same neocon authors,
right.
Rebuilding America's defenses. And I don't know one person in the U.S. who would ever, ever refer to the United States, our country, our homeland. They wouldn't use that term, homeland. They would say America, the United States. It smacks of its German origin, but there it is. And Hitler introduced it in the 1934 Nuremberg rally.
Right. I think some people would say this maybe tells us something about the people who wrote this, publication.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how does this function? You know, because one does think of Nazi Germany, it seems so odd to be using it of your own country. You'd think that the effect that would have on people would make them think, oh, just a minute, this isn't talking about protecting our home from invaders. This is making us think that we are the baddies on the world stage. I mean, it's an odd one to use.
Well, I think it works really well because it creates the concept of home and security. You know, our little home, protect our home.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it conjures up Hitlerian images. Our little home is being attacked by, the big bad wolf. And we're the three little pigs here in our home. And we better build a brick home because the wolf will blow down our straw home. And so let's create a massive agency called Homeland Security, and then we will be secure in our brick home. And if the wolf comes to get us, it will come down the chimney and we'll take care of it. So I think it works in multiple, very subtle, tricky ways.
Yes, and I think actually the way you put it there is very helpful. So it's actually the term homeland security that makes it work so well. If it was just talking about the homeland all the time, it might make people think, well, what's going on here? But to talk about homeland security does actually put that interpretation on that the homeland is something good to be protected. And as you say, there are the Hitlerian images there which can then float around that place of security and create a sense of paranoia. Yeah, so I think if we center in the term homeland security, I can see that how that might work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your third one here, again, to do with World War II connotations, is Ground Zero. Now, you say this term was first applied to 9/11 by the guy called Mark Walsh, who's often referred to as the Harley guy because of that Harley Davidson t-shirt he was wearing. He was identified as a Fox News freelance reporter, I think. And he used this term, and also was famous, of course, and we've mentioned this on the show before, he was famous for that phrase talking about the towers mostly coming down, mostly due to structural failure because the fire was too intense, which always sounds scripted, a very, very odd remark. But apparently he was the first to use this term with respect to that day. Now, you think that this term Ground Zero is also possibly something that is manipulative?
Well, I do think it is clearly manipulative. First of all, it conjures up the thoughts of nuclear weapons, the planes hitting the towers and so forth. That was not nuclear weapons. It was something other than that. Before and after September 11th, the United States was talking a lot, and George Bush was talking a lot about Saddam Hussein and nuclear weapons, Russia and nuclear weapons, pulling out of the ABM treaty, which Bush had announced early in the year. So there was a tremendous amount of talk about nuclear weapons. The connotation from Ground Zero, of course, is nuclear weapons. And then in December of that year, of 2001, I think it was around December 11th or something like that, right early in December, Bush announces, you know, we're out of the ABM treaty with Russia. And what is the reason? It's all connected to the attacks of September 11th, which have nothing whatsoever to do with Russia, nuclear weapons, and the ABM treaty. And it's another step down this road that Trump has just exacerbated by pulling out of the intermediate treaty in Europe with Russia. So, you know, Ground Zero, nuclear weapons, the bad guys are coming to get us, they're going to nuke us, there must be weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, right, and so on and so forth. So I think it's really powerful. And
right. So are you saying essentially that 9/11 event was infused with the seriousness and the dire threat of nuclear war, although it didn't involve that, but nevertheless people were encouraged to interpret it in that way so that it would be useful as a symbol for the future to represent that kind of threat?
Absolutely. Yes. Hmm. Yes.
Oh, fascinating. So I want to pause for a moment to consider this World War II language here, because you have other ones that are not this, but these three main ones here are connoting the Second World War. You mention World War II as being the good war, by which I presume you're meaning that's how most people perceive it, and therefore that perception can be used when you're trying to influence the public. So my question here is, do you think that the main function of this connotation language is to say something like, we, the US in this case, we are the good guys. After all, we were the good guys in World War II. So that makes it, coming back to this term again, that makes it unthinkable, that makes it unspeakable, that we, in inverted commas, I'm not talking about the individual people living in the country, but, you know, we, as a collective sense, we are, in this case, not the good guys. We're good. The enemy's bad. It's that simple. And this language prevents us from thinking in that kind of way. Do you think that's the main function of this kind of language?
Yes, I do. Hmm. You summed it up quite well. To create a mythic frame of reference for the good guys versus the bad guys. And we know who the good guys are and we know who the bad guys are. And, you know, we would never be bad because we're good.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And that also reinforces the notion that if you're a voice of dissent, then you're not just a critic of your own government. You are, in fact, an enemy voice, doesn't it?
Yes, and you're bad.
And you're bad, yeah.
Mm. Bad boy. Like a dog, you know. When a dog jumps up, takes a piece of meat off the table.
Yeah, I mean, we had something of this. I think this is quite creepy, actually. And we had something of this creepiness a few years back. And, you know, it's there all the time, but it really came to the surface with our previous Prime Minister here, David Cameron, where he was implying that people who question, I think he was talking at the United Nations, and he said something along the lines of people who question events like 9/11, 7/7, they are even unwittingly supporting the narrative of ISIS, something creepy like that. A lot of people were very disturbed by him saying that. But again, this fits very much with this way of thinking that if you are a voice of dissent, you are somehow allied to the enemy. And this kind of language we're discussing is very powerful, isn't it, at reinforcing that way of thinking and making alternative thoughts both unthinkable and unspeakable.
Yes, it's very insidious, very powerful. I'm always reminded of Orwell. Mm-hmm. And of course, Great Britain has been a partner of the US in so much of this evil doing.
Yeah. Do you think also the term war on terror nestles into this type of language as well, that it's equally manipulative?
Oh, it's totally manipulative because it doesn't make any sense first,
Yeah.
because you can't wage a war on terror. Terror is a tactic, but it connotes the idea that terror is a thing, such as in a noun, that there are people who are the terror and we're waging war on these people, which we are. And it brings me to that other term that I try not to use, that I have used twice already because of my own stupidity and brainwashing, 9/11. The 9/11 meme, which I believe is a central one, was created to create this idea of an ongoing emergency. Here in the U.S., 9/11 is the emergency phone number. If someone's sick or is having a heart attack or there's a fire, you dial 911. So it creates this sense of a never-ending emergency, a never-ending war on terror that can never end, because how are you going to defeat terror? They're always going to be there. And so I think they're linked, 9/11, the war on terror, and we know that it's never ended. It's going on right now.
Yes, indeed. You say it's against people, but it's not even defined who those people are, is it? Well, they use words like extremists. And of course, what does that mean? It seems to be a war on whoever the state says is the enemy. And it's that fluid. And it goes on forever. And I think that is really very disturbing.
Yes. And, you know, it's been essentially Muslims. Mm-hmm. Of course, they could switch that whenever they want.
Absolutely. And I think that's why people were spooked, particularly by things like what we heard there from David Cameron. You saw the beginnings of that, where it could be switched to anybody who's asking a question. Very disturbing. So although that's an example from the past, I don't think that's by any means left us, has it? I think there's going to be more of that in the future.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yes. So coming back to this term, 9/11, which you link to the emergency telephone number, I mean, some might say, well, you know, isn't that just a coincidence? I mean, what are you saying, that the number was chosen? Or are you saying that the date was chosen for the event to correspond with that number? What are you suggesting here?
Well, I don't know if the date was chosen. It surely could have been. I can't say. But I do know that on September 12th, the New York Times published an op-ed piece by then a writer who later became a war hawk, a promoter of the Iraq War, named Bill Keller. And he wrote an op-ed piece on the morning of September 12th with the title America's Emergency Line 9/11. And that is where this term took off from. And within that article, he kept saying, now the United States knows what it's like to be an Israeli. Now the U.S. knows what it's like to be an Israeli. And he kept repeating this. I can't recall how many times, maybe 9 or 10 times in this article. But afterwards, that caught on. And so they started to refer to the attacks of that day as 9/11. But never before in American history has a day ever been called by numbers. You know, Pearl Harbor was called the attacks on Pearl Harbor. I mean, there's no such incident.
Yes, we've got used to it, haven't we? But that's since 9/11, isn't it? I'm thinking immediately, of course, and I've mentioned it before, 7/7. That comes just from the fact that 9/11's already called that. So you can't think of any title before that.
No, I can't. Mm. No, but it pushes all the right anxiety buttons in its short and snappy 9/11, 9/11, 9/11, 9/11. And yes, especially here in the U.S., it is a scary term.
You don't discuss this in the piece, but what do you think of the term World Trade Center? Again, you could just say, well, you know, it just happened to be the World Trade Center. Why are you making a thing of it? But of course, somebody, whoever was responsible for it, decided that it should be the World Trade Center that was hit. Was part of that decision a linguistic mind control decision? It's not impossible. So do you think that World Trade Center might connote, obviously, America, but beyond that, connote the globe or the international community, understood as being essentially centered in the West? Could it be something along those lines?
Well, that's a really interesting question and insight, something that I've never thought of. So, yes, I'd have to say you're probably onto something there. I would need to think about it a little further, but just my initial reaction would be, wow, that's an insight. And thank you for saying it.
Not at all. It just occurred to me, and I'm going to invite listeners to think along these lines as well. There may be quite a few that we've missed, and it would be very interesting to get emails from people with suggestions. Because if this kind of thing is going on, we should expect that there would be other examples of it. Now, a lot of this could be put down to just coincidence, but I want to quote from Lance de Haven Smith. Now, this is from his book, Conspiracy Theory in America, and you put this in the essays, and I think it's an excellent quote. I'm going to quote it here. Quote, "The rapidity with which the new language of the war on terror appeared and took hold, the synergy between terms and their mutual connections to World War II nomenclatures, and above all the connections between many terms and the emergency motif of 9/11 and 9/11, any one of these factors alone, but certainly all of them together, raise the possibility that work on this linguistic construct began long before 9/11. It turns out that elite political crime, even treason, may actually be official policy." So I think that is an important paragraph there. If you take just these one at a time, they may seem like, well, there's nothing to it. But if you think of them all together, there may well be something going on here.
I agree. And I think that quote from Lance de Haven Smith's book is really fantastic.
Indeed, I thought it was important to include.
Yeah, and then if you look at what I call linguistic mind control and September 11th and the new book, 9/11 Unmasks, and you take the terminology, the language, and you put it side by side with 9/11 Unmasked and how that book and those studies show that the official explanation is ridiculous. It is absurd. It makes no logical sense from any standpoint. And you have the two things together. You really have a very, very powerful argument about what happened on that day and why what is still going on now, because we're living with it.
Indeed, we are. Yes. As I've often said on this program, I think that's when the 21st century started, in any meaningful sense. A very frightening century in many ways. I want to ask you a question that is tricky to ask. I've already primed you about this one, but I want to ask it because it connects with things that we've talked about to do with civil religion or civic religion, particularly the conversation we had with Dr. Martin Erdmann on this. And this subject has come up a number of times on the show, an important issue, I think. So I mentioned in my initial email to you my reservations about the supposed parallels that some people see between the images and the symbols of 9/11 and occult symbolism and numerology, that kind of thing. Interesting. You know, I don't discount the possibility that there may be such connections. I mean, if there are individuals with occult leanings involved in this event, it's certainly possible they might have designed events to coincide with such symbols, you know. But I'm just saying that I'm not persuaded at the moment by that kind of thing. But, and this is what I'm working up to here with my question to you, but I do wonder if there is possibly a spiritual dimension to this language. I'm wondering if one of the functions of this linguistic mind control is to, the function of it is to steer the population in terms of their minds, and the psychological and the spiritual are deeply connected. I believe they are deeply connected. So might this language be even darker than what we've been discussing? Not just controlling the psychological side of mind, but also influencing at a spiritual level of mind. Might there be that in view by people using this kind of language? Do you think there's anything to that way of asking the question?
Absolutely. I think there's a great deal there. There's a whole history of civil religion in the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm a sociologist, and so one of my specialties since I started in theology and then moved to sociology is the sociology of religion and the equation of the state with God, with, in this country, Christianity, in God we trust, and all of that kind of thing has been used for a very, very, very long time. And in the case of September 11th, and the ongoing war on terror, it is used continuously by the politicians, by the leaders. I think some of the occult stuff is also a way of dividing people, of confusing them, by putting out some occult suggestions that are just a dead end.
Right.
But it's interesting to me that people who are interested in or who have worked on the September 11th stuff, David Ray Griffin is a theologian, Graham McQueen, a professor of religious studies. I am trained in theology, and there are many, many people who have deep religious spiritual background who are involved in trying to tell the truth about these matters. And so I think we all suspect at some level we have a spiritual obligation to not go into the occult world, but to go into the world of the Judeo-Christian prophetic heritage to say these things are wrong, they are false, and they must be opposed. But in the name of that tradition, in the name of our spiritual values.
Absolutely, and to wrench back these terms from the way they've been abused and connected to this language we've been talking about. So to wrench back the term God and even America and freedom, even democracy, you know, these kinds of things. And in fact, to take back the words of Jesus. Bush used them, didn't he? You know, anyone's not with us is against us, and that sort of thing. Misappropriate the language of Christ there. So, yeah, I think it's important to pull that language back into its real meaning and move it out of its abuse, which we have seen and continue to see. So, I mean, we've hinted at this a number of times during the conversation that we need a new vocabulary. We've criticized ourselves endlessly for saying 9/11. So we should avoid 9/11, should we, as a term? Should we avoid saying the attacks? I mean, obviously they were attacks in a sense, but that does suggest that it's entirely an outside caused event. Again, terrorist attack. Okay, it's a terrorist attack, but again, it has this connotation of the holy other coming from outside to attack the mainland, and it may not have been just that, as we've been discussing. So should we avoid those sorts of terms and use different terms?
Well, I tried to avoid the term 9/11, but as you saw in this conversation, I used it twice.
I used it many more times than you, so I'll let you off.
Yes, I think we should avoid that term, but I don't have an alternative, and that's the problem. If some of your listeners could suggest something, that would be wonderful. I've discussed this with, I know, with Graham McQueen and others, but it's a tough one. It's hard to come up with a, like I had suggested saying the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, and that has its problems, as you pointed out.
Yeah. It's a mouthful as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's too long. It's too long.
Maybe just September 11. Maybe everybody knows what that is.
That might be the best, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What do you think of terms like deep state and false flag and state crime against democracy? Do you think those are useful things to use?
Well, I have mixed feelings about them. I use them in place of other terms. I don't use the term that Lance DeHaven Smith uses, state crimes against democracy. Uh-huh. Not that I find it objectionable. It's just that I'm not sure there's a democracy to be against to begin with.
Yeah, I wonder that actually. When we should say state crime against humanity, perhaps, or something like that.
Yeah. The term false flag, I think, has to be used judiciously, because, of course, there have been many false flags in history. What was the third term that you...
Deep state.
The deep state is being overused now, I think, and I have used it myself, but it used to be called, by a sociologist called, the power elite. You know, the terms have changed over the decades, but when the mass media, the corporate mass media, starts using the term, you know it's in trouble.
Yeah, indeed. That's a good point. The power elite was overused as well, wasn't it? I know that deep state and false flag, they've both become sort of red rag terms now to spot conspiracy theorists. You know, oh, if they're using that kind of term, that means they're, you know, they're wearing a tinfoil hat. So, yeah, all of these terms seem to have a shelf life, don't they?
Yes, I remember writing an article about almost 2 years ago with the title, "The Deep State Has Gone Shallow." So I don't know, Julian. It's a tough one. I know that language is the key. I think that the poets, the really insightful people, who is your great Harold Pinter, a great British playwright, he knew that language was central. I think the really deep thinkers know that it is with language that we're going to live or die, because this is how we communicate.
Yes, I'm interested that you brought up Harold Pinter there, because he knew the power of very few words. One of his hallmarks, isn't it, of course, is to have very sparse dialogue. But those words are each very powerful in their context. And that's what we're talking about, aren't we? And I'm wondering, as we're talking here, whether what we need is a certain agility in the way we use language, that we shouldn't allow ourselves to sit too long with a particular term, because, it, as we said before, it has a shelf life. So perhaps if we are thinking nimbly about the language that we are using and the language that is possibly manipulating us, then we can keep changing the terms. As long as we're explaining to ourselves and to others what we're talking about, maybe we can escape these manipulations by having this nimble dialogue, recognizing that language is very powerful.
That's said beautifully. I love the way you said that. And I love the way you used the word nimble.
Thank you.
You know, Jack be nimble, Jack be quick, Jack jump over the candles.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's what we need. Yes, let's have nimble minds as we think ourselves and as we discuss with other people. Well, thank you ever so much for coming on, Edward. It has been wonderful speaking to you. I've really enjoyed reading your pieces, but also having this conversation, and a kind of conversation where it's not just, you know, asking you to divulge your research, but a kind of back and forth where we've talked about things also that are perhaps new and speculative, and even invited members of the audience to engage in the conversation as well through email. So I'm going to repeat that. Please, if you have anything constructive to add to this conversation, then please do contact the website, which of course is themindrenewed.com, and you'll find the email address on the website. So once again, thank you ever so much for coming on the show. Your website I've mentioned before, and you've got a lot of writing on there, but you also publish a lot at Global Research, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yes, at Global, Off Guardian, many different places. Yeah. Yes.
So I direct people to go and read the articles there, because there's a great deal of very interesting material indeed. Thank you ever so much for coming on the program. I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, thank you, Julian. I enjoyed it. And I think what you said is it was a conversation. And that's far better than answering straightforward questions. We put a lot out there for people to think about, and your contribution was fantastic. Thank you.
That's very generous of you. Thank you ever so much. A wonderful conversation.